This is a CBC podcast.
Support for delivery of this podcast comes from the Buick Enclave, the finest luxury crossover ever. Visit buick.gm.ca to see that where there's passion, there's beauty.
This is Special Delivery, a podcast where short-run series from CBC Radio get a second chance at fame and you get a second chance to listen. I'm Sharon Farrell. The 2007 Massey Lectures are coming up, and the series is called City of Words with best-selling author Alberto Mangel. You can hear it on the CBC Radio 1 program Ideas throughout the week of November the 5th. As a special treat to whet your Massey appetite, we're taking a look back at five of our most memorable Massey Lectures. This week, the opening lecture from a pillar of the American Civil Rights Movement, Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. Given in 1967, his series centered on a critical topic of the times, the African-American fight for freedom.
Just as the storming of the Bastille in 1789 was the French masses' symbolic assault against absolutism, the riots are an early warning to white America that patience has run out.
Ideas presents Dr. Martin Luther King in the first of five Massey Lectures for 1967. Unlike its predecessors, this year's lectures are by a man who is noted at least as much for his part in making history as for his analytic abilities. In tonight's talk, Dr. King discusses the relative merits of violent and nonviolent approaches to racial problems. Dr. Martin Luther King.
It is a deep personal privilege to address a nationwide Canadian audience. Over and above any kinship of United States citizens and Canadians as North Americans, that is a singular historical relationship between American Negroes and Canadians. Canada is not merely a neighbor to Negroes. Deep in our history of struggle for freedom, Canada was a North Star. The Negro slave denied education, dehumanized and imprisoned on curl plantations, knew that far to the north a land existed where a fugitive slave, if he survived the horrors of the journey, could find freedom. The legendary Underground Railroad started in the South and ended in Canada. The Freedom Road links us together. Our spirituals, now so widely admired around the world, were often codes. We sang of heaven that awaited us, and the slave masters listened in innocence, not realizing that we were not speaking of the hereafter. Heaven was the word for Canada, and the Negro sang of the hope that his escape on the Underground Railroad would carry him there. And so, standing today in Canada, I am linked with the history of my people and its unity with your past. The Underground Railroad could not bring freedom to many Negroes, yet it did something far greater. It symbolized a hope when freedom was almost an impossible dream. Our spirit never died, even though the weight of centuries was a crushing burden. Our freedom was not won a century ago. It is not won today. But some small part of it is in our hands, and we are marching no longer by ones and twos, but in legions of thousands, convinced now that it cannot be denied by any human force. Today the question is not whether we shall be free, but by what course we will win. In the recent past, our struggle has had two phases. The first phase began in the early 50s, when Negroes slammed the door shut on submission and subservience. Adapting nonviolent resistance to conditions in the United States, we swept into southern streets to demand our citizenship and manhood. For the South, with its complex system of brutal segregation, we were inaugurating a rebellion. Merely to march in public streets was to rock the status quo to its roots, boycotting buses in Montgomery, demonstrating in Birmingham, the citadel of segregation, and defying guns, dogs, and clubs in Selma, while maintaining disciplined nonviolence, totally confused the rulers of the South. If they let us march, they admitted their lie that the black man was content. If they shot us down, they told the world they were inhuman brutes. They tried to stop us by threats and fears, the tactic that had long worked so effectively. But nonviolence had muzzled their guns, and Negro defiance had shaken their confidence. When they finally reached for clubs, dogs, and guns, they found the world was watching, and then the power of nonviolent protest became manifest. It dramatized the essential meaning of the conflict, and in magnified strokes made clear who was the evildoer and who was the undeserving victim. The nation and the world were sickened, and through national legislation wiped out 1,000 Southern laws, ripping gaping holes in the edifice of segregation. These were days of luminous victories. Negroes and whites collaborated for human dignity. But there was a limitation to our achievements. Negroes were outraged by inequality. Their ultimate goal was freedom. Most of the white majority were outraged by brutality. Their goal was improvement, not freedom or equality. When Negroes could use public facilities, register and vote in some areas of the South, and find token educational advancement, again in token form, find new areas of employment, it brought to the Negro a sense of achievement, but it brought to the whites a sense of completion. When Negroes assertively moved on to ascend the second rung of the ladder, a firm resistance from the white community developed. This resistance characterized the second phase which we are now experiencing. The arresting of the limited forward progress by white resistance revealed the latent racism which was deeply rooted in United States society. Everyone underestimated the amount of bigotry the white majority was disguising, and the amount of violence and rage Negroes were suppressing. Nonviolence as a protest form came under attack as a tactical theory, and all the Negroes expressed their dismay and hostility in a succession of riots. The riots are now in the center of the stage and are being offered as basis for contradictory positions by whites and Negroes. Some Negroes argue they are the incipient forms for rebellion and guerrilla tactics that will be the feature of the Negro revolt. They are represented as the new stage of Negro struggle, replacing the old and allegedly outworn tactic of nonviolent resistance. At the same time, some white forces are using riots as evidence that Negroes have no capacity for constructive change, and in their lawless behavior forfeit all rights and justify any form of repressive measures. I would like to examine both questions. Is the guilt for riots exclusively that of Negroes, and are they a natural development to a new stage of struggle? A million words will be written and spoken to dissect the ghetto outbreaks, but for a perceptive and vivid expression of culpability, I would submit two sentences written a century ago by Victor Hugo. If the soul is left in darkness, sins will be committed. The guilty one is not he who commits the sin, but he who causes the darkness. The policymakers of the white society have caused the darkness. They created discrimination. They created slums. They perpetuate unemployment and poverty. It is incontestable and deplorable that Negroes have committed crimes, but they are derivative crimes. They are born of the greater crimes of the white society. When we ask Negroes to abide by the law, let us also declare that the white man does not abide by law in the ghettos. Day in and day out, he violates welfare laws to deprive the poor of their meager allotments. He flagrantly violates building codes and regulations. His police make a mockery of law. He violates laws on equal employment and education. The slums are the handiwork of a vicious system of the white society. Negroes live in them, but they do not make them any more than a prisoner makes a prison. Let us say it forthrightly, that if the total slum violations of law by the white man over the years were calculated and compared with the lawbreaking of a few days of riots, the hardened criminal would be the white man. In using the term white man, I am seeking to describe in general terms the Negro's adversary. It is not meant to encompass all white people. There are millions who have morally risen above prevailing prejudices. They are willing to share power and to accept structural alterations of society, even at the cost of traditional privilege. To deny that existence, as some ultra-nationalists do, is to deny an evident truth. It is not the race per se that we fight, but the policies and ideology formulated by leaders of that race to perpetuate oppression. To sum up the general causes of riots, we would have to say that the white power structure is still seeking to keep the walls of segregation and inequality substantially intact, while Negro determination to break through them has intensified. The irony is that the white society ruefully complains that if there were no chaos, great changes would come, yet it creates the circumstances breeding the chaos. Within the general cause of riots, it is possible to identify five specific elements. The white backlash is a primary cause because it explains the ferocity of the emotional content of the outbursts and their spontaneity. Negroes have endured insults and humiliation for decades and centuries. But in the past 10 years, a growing sensitivity in the white community was a gratifying indication of progress. The depravity of the white backlash shattered the hope that new attitudes were in the making. The reversion to barbaric white conduct marked by a succession of murders in the South, the recrudescence of white hoodlumism in northern cities, and coldly systematic withdrawal of support by some erstwhile white allies constituted a grim statement to Negroes. They were told there were firm limits to their progress, that they must expect to remain permanently unequal and permanently poor. The pervasiveness of discriminatory practices is so taken for granted that its provocative effect is easily forgotten. There are generational differences among Negroes. The older generation has substantially inured itself to daily insults, but a younger generation has a lower threshold of tolerance. An agonizing discrimination cuts off too large a part of their life to be endured in silence and apathy. Even when a Negro manages to grasp a foothold on the economic ladder, discrimination remains to push him off after he has ascended a few rungs. It hounds him at every level to stultify his initiative and insult his being. And for the pitifully few who climb into economic security, it persists and closes different doors to them. Intimately related to discrimination is one of its worst consequences, unemployment. The United States teetered on the edge of revolution in the 1930s when unemployment ranged up to 25%. Today, in the midst of historic prosperity, unemployment for Negro youth, according to government figures, runs as high as 30 to 40% in many cities. With most of their lives yet to live, the slamming of doors in their faces can be expected to induce rage and rebellion. The fourth cause is the war in Vietnam. Negroes are conscripted in double measure for combat. They constitute more than 20% of the frontline troops in a war of unprecedented brutality, although their proportion in the population is 10%. They are marching under slogans of democracy to defend a Saigon government that scorns democracy. At home, they know that is no genuine democracy for their people, and on their return, they will be restored to a grim life as second-class citizens, even if they are bedecked with heroes' medals. Finally, a complex of causes is found in the degenerating conditions of urban life. The cities are choked with polluted air, dense traffic, and insufficient water. Public facilities are outworn and inadequate. Within this chaos of neglect, Negroes are stifled at the very bottom in slums so squalid that their equal is not to be found in any other industrial nation of the world. Most of the largest cities are victims of the large migration of Negroes. Although it was well known that millions of Negroes would be forced off the land in the South by the contraction of agricultural employment during the past two decades, no national planning was done to provide remedies. When white immigrants arrived in the United States in the late 19th century, a beneficent government gave them free land and credit to build a useful, independent life. In contrast, when the Negro migrated, he was left to his own resources. He crowded the cities and was herded into ghettos, left in unemployment or subjected to gross exploitation within a context of searing discrimination. Though other minorities had encountered obstacles, none was so brutally scorned nor so consistently denied opportunities as the Negro. All of these conditions were the fuel for violence and riots. As the social psychologist Kenneth Clark has said, it is a surprise only that outbreaks were not experienced earlier. That a thoughtful social scientist who are now acknowledging that the elements of social catastrophe have accumulated in such vast array that no remedies may be available. I am not sanguine, but I am not ready to accept defeat. I believe there are several programs that can reverse the tide of social disintegration. And beyond that, I believe that destructive as the riots may be, they have been analyzed substantially in a one-sided fashion. That is a striking aspect to the violence of riots that has stimulated little comment and even less analysis. In all of the riots taken together, The property damage reached colossal proportions, exceeding $1 billion. Yet the physical injury inflicted by Negroes upon white people was inconsequential in comparison. The bruising edge of the weapon of violence in Negro hands was employed almost exclusively against property, not persons. It is noteworthy that many distinguished periodicals and leaders of the white community, even while the conflict raged, in clear terms accepted the responsibility for neglect, evasion, and centuries of injustice. They did not seek to fasten exclusive culpability on the Negro. They asked for action and a facing up to the need for drastic social reformation. It is true that not all were motivated by morality. The crisis of Negro aspirations intersects with the urban crisis. Some white liberals may not be moved by humanity to save Negroes, but they are moved by self-interest to save their cities. But even their moral and selfish motives, which merge toward a constructive end, have not yet made government act. It is preoccupied with war and is determined to husband every resource for military adventures rather than social reconstruction. Negroes must therefore not only formulate a program, but they must fashion new tactics which do not count on government goodwill, but instead serve to compel unwilling authorities to yield to the mandates of justice. We are demanding an emergency program to provide employment for everyone in need of a job, or if a work program is impractical, a guaranteed annual income at levels that sustain life in decent circumstances. It is now incontestable that the wealth and resources of the United States make the elimination of poverty absolutely practical. A second feature of our program is the demolition of slums and rebuilding by the population that live in them. There is scarcely any division among Negroes about these measures. Divisions arise only around methods for that achievement. I am still convinced that a solution of nonviolence remains possible. However, nonviolence must be adapted to urban conditions and urban moods. The effectiveness of street marches in cities is limited because the normal turbulence of city life absorbs them as mere transitory drama quite common in the ordinary movement of masses. In the South, a march was a social earthquake. In the North, it is a faint, brief exclamation of protest. Nonviolent protest must now mature to a new level to correspond to heightened black impatience and stiffened white resistance. This higher level is mass civil disobedience. There must be more than a statement to the larger society. There must be a force that interrupts its functioning at some key point. That interruption must, however, not be clandestine or surreptitious. It is not necessary to invest it with guerrilla romanticism. It must be open and, above all, conducted by large masses without violence. If the jails are filled to thwart it, the meaning will become even clearer. The Negro will be saying, "I am not avoiding penalties for breaking the law. I am willing to endure all your punishment, because your society will not be able to endure the stigma of violently and publicly oppressing its minority to preserve injustice." Mass civil disobedience as a new stage of struggle can transmute the deep rage of the ghetto into a creative force. to dislocate the functioning of a city without destroying it can be more effective than a riot because it can be longer lasting, costly to the larger society, but not wantonly destructive. Finally, it is a device of social action that is more difficult for the government to quell by superior force. The limitation of riots, moral questions aside, is that they cannot win, and their participants know it. Hence, it is not revolutionary, but reactionary, because it invites defeat. It involves an emotional catharsis, but it must be followed by a sense of futility. Where does the future point? The character of the next period is being determined by the response of the white decision makers to this crisis. It is a harsh indictment, but it is an inescapable conclusion that Congress is not horrified with the conditions of Negro life, but with the product of these conditions, the Negro himself. It could, by a single massive act of concern, expressed in a multi-billion-dollar program to modernize and humanize Negro communities, do more to obviate violence than could be done by all the armies at its command. Whether it will summon the wisdom to do it is the question of the hour. It is a shattering historical irony that the American Revolution of 1776 was a consequence of many of the same conditions that prevail today. King George adamantly refused to share power, even in modest degree, with the colonies. He provoked violence by scorning appeals embodied in nonviolent protests, such as boycotts, peaceful demonstrations, and petitions. In their resort to violence, the colonists were pressed ideologically beyond their original demands and put into question the system of absolute monarchical rule. When they took up arms and searched for the rationale for independence, they broke with all traditions of imperial domination and established a unique and unprecedented form of government, the Democratic Republic. The Negro revolt, too, is evolving. Now it is more than a quest for desegregation and equality. It faces a system that has created miracles of production and technology and challenges it to create justice. If humanism is locked outside of the system, Negroes will have revealed its inner court of despotism, and a far greater struggle for liberation will unfold. The United States is substantially challenged to demonstrate that it can abolish not only the evils of racism, but the tragedy of poverty of whites as well as Negroes, and above all, the horrors of war that transcend the national borders and involve all of mankind. The first man to die in the American Revolution was a Negro seaman, Crispus Attucks. Before that fateful struggle ended, the institution of absolute monarchy was put on its deathbed. We may now only be in the initial period of an era of change as far-reaching in its consequences as the American Revolution. The developed industrial nations of the world, which include Canada as much as the United States, cannot remain secure islands of prosperity in a seething sea of poverty. A storm is rising against the privileged minority of the earth, from which there is no shelter in isolation and armament. The storm will not abate until a just distribution of the fruits of the earth enables man everywhere to live in dignity and human decency. the American Negro of 1967, like Crispus Attucks, may be the vanguard in a prolonged struggle that may change the shape of the world as billions of deprived shake and transform the earth in their quest for life, freedom, and justice.
You may also enjoy reading the entire lecture series in a new book called The Lost Massey Lectures, Recovered Classics from Five Great Thinkers. For more information on the book, go to the CBC Radio Literary website, Words at Large, at cbc.ca/wordsatlarge. In the coming weeks, we'll give you more samples of the Lost Massey Lectures. Next Friday, hear social critic Dr. Paul Goodman with his talks from 1966. I'm Sharon Farrell. Thanks for listening.
Hi, I'm Nora Young, the host of Spark on CBC Radio. What is Spark, you ask? Well, Spark is...
Spark is online.
Spark is interactive.
Spark is a conversation.
Conversation.
Spark is digital.
Spark is a new kind of radio show.
You can check out the Spark blog, contribute to the show, and download the podcast at cbc.ca/spark.